I think you said it earlier in our conversation, a little humble pie is good.
Yeah.
That happened earlier in my career. I was a shooting star in the organization and the top producer, and then I had a huge problem in my portfolio, and I got sent to the credit policy area of the bank, and I was unhappy about that. But I learned more, and eventually I was running that area.
Right.
So it was a great opportunity for me because I failed in spectacular fashion, but I was able to come back from that. It was a good learning lesson for me.
Welcome to Boston Blockchain, where we focus on the people and projects that are driving innovation in the industry. I'm Kyle Hedman of China Shop Productions, and today's guest is Ken Mooney, angel investor with Chain Reaction and professor at Suffolk University. In this episode, Ken and I discuss the evolving landscape of blockchain technology and the role of angel investing in supporting early stage companies. We also discuss the challenges startups face and the significance of inclusion, collaboration, and trust in fostering innovation. Check out the links in the show notes for more info. Now let's meet the professor. All right, Ken, it's a pleasure to meet you, man. Thanks for taking the time to come down here to talk to us today.
You know, the pleasure's all mine. What an exciting next 3 days this is going to be, not only for the Chain Reaction Angel Group, but really for blockchain in general.
Oh, for sure. One of the really cool things, too, is as you were walking in to get a cup of coffee before we started here, one of the other presenters, was it Eduardo? I heard him stop by. No way, that's my professor. So you actually taught him, huh? Is that true?
There's actually two of the interns here were in my Blockchain Revolution class last semester, and they were just two outstanding students.
Well, how did you get involved with teaching blockchain tech at Suffolk? Because that doesn't seem like the type of offerings that most colleges have.
Yeah, well, I think, how did I start teaching? Mm. So I had retired and gotten into investing, and actually I had started a fintech company based in New York, and I was doing that for 3 years or so. But along the way, I'm a grad at Suffolk University, a double RAM, and one of the professors couldn't teach this course. It was on, you know, the financial crisis. And of course, I had been chief credit officer of State Street Corporation during the financial crisis, and I knew a lot about it. So they asked me to teach it. And I said, oh, wow, I really enjoy this. I really enjoy speaking to students, et cetera. And so I taught a few courses. And then the head of the finance department said, we want to teach this course in blockchain. Mm-hmm. But the professor who's going to do it has left the university. And you have done a lot in fintech, and actually you designed a course in fintech. Mm-hmm. Could you do the same for blockchain? So I've taught it 4 times. I teach it every other semester. Mm-hmm. It's in the fall semester. This semester, actually, I'm teaching intro to fintech.
Okay.
And last night, the segment was on blockchain.
So what sort of things do you cover in this class then?
So in the blockchain course, what I try to do is give people a basis, an overall view of blockchain. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some of the technology, but I try to talk about how it can be something that can be more inclusive. Mm. You know, there's over 2 billion people that are relatively unbanked or underbanked in the world, and blockchain can be one of those technologies that kind of unlocks that. So I talk about that. I talk about blockchain is not just crypto. Because a lot of people, most of my class have owned crypto at some point or own it right now, and they think crypto and blockchain are the same thing. And what I like to do is I like to show them blockchain can be used for a lot of different things.
Yes. In fact, that's kind of one of the questions I had for another guest yesterday was, can blockchain tech exist without the crypto? Because crypto can't exist without blockchain because that's the underlying tech, but can you have applications of blockchain without having an underlying coin or something trading against it?
True blockchain, there isn't a third party, right? So you have to have consensus approval. So you have to have, why are people going to do the work to do the consensus approval?
Right.
They need to get a reward. So that's kind of what Bitcoin and Ethereum are all about. But there is, you know, permission blockchain, like IBM has permission, like Hyperledger Fabric. So you're part of this permission group of mostly businesses that approve things. It's a smaller group that does the consensus approvals. Mm-hmm. So it can work without it, but most of blockchain, I think you'll find, is involved with some sort of a token or a crypto reward.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense then. So tell me about Chain Reaction then. How long have you been involved with this company?
About 2.5 years. It's an angel group that focuses on pre-seed or seed investment in blockchain or Web3 types of early stage companies. And it was actually through Suffolk University that I got involved, because I volunteered to be a judge in executive presentation. And one of the other judges was a member of Chain Reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I was putting this course together in blockchain. He said, oh, well, you should come to our angel investing group.
Right.
And so I did. My colleagues are great people. We make direct investments.
Right.
We're not a fund, although maybe a fund is in our future at some point. But we're all individual angels. We make direct investments. It's not only about investing, it's about learning. Because on a monthly or a bi-monthly basis, we have learning sessions about blockchain, and we're learning more and more, and we have a sense of what the cycles are. There's a lot of different cycles. You know, DeFi all of a sudden is very popular, and now DePIN is a big thing. Now Bitcoin is, because of ordinals and runes and things like that, has become, all of a sudden, it's popped up again in terms of the types of companies we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, once a month, we'll have a pitch session, and we'll take, you know, maybe we'll have 10 to 20 applications. We pick two or three, and they pitch to our group, and we decide whether we want to make an investment or not in that company.
It's not just investments that you guys do with them either. It looks like there's a lot of resources that you provide them as far as like valuable experience or other types of mentorship. Probably not the right word, but I'd say advisement maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's not unusual. You know, the pluses of angel investing, number one is the money, right?
Right.
Number two is that you might have an angel that's walked in your moccasins before, in your
right.
shoes before, and they may have some expertise or make connections for you. I have, in one circumstance, I'm a board observer, so I attend all the board meetings of this particular company, which I happen to invest in, and I help organize a second round through our angel group, and we worked with a venture capital firm. So, but I'm schooling the people. They're two young brothers that started the company. They're based in Tennessee. And I'm schooling them on governance. I'm schooling them how to make a proper pitch. I'm schooling them. They did a small asset sale. I'm schooling them on how to read the documents, you know, because one of the rounds was a preferred stock round. It was a price round. They had never seen that before. So, and you have to remember, with a lot of these small companies, they don't have a deep bench of management.
Right.
Because they can't pay for it.
Well, yeah, most of the time it's somebody like a small business, so they're trying to start it on their own, right? And you just don't know what you don't know in those situations.
Exactly. And as a person that started two companies on my own, I probably have made every mistake known to all people in mankind. But, you know, you try to obviate that so they don't make the same mistakes. But everything's a learning process. And I also learned from them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, this particular company uses blockchain in healthcare,
mm-hmm.
which we're really excited about, because it's not all about just decentralized finance and financial applications. This is actually for healthcare.
That's actually been one of the biggest surprises of participating in this event was the whole, there's a 2-day event going on for just blockchain and medical technology. And watching some of those presentations, it's like, wow. There's some really cool potential applications for blockchain here.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about blockchain, as I talked about with my students last night, this is a technology that's still pretty new.
Yep.
And there's so many different platforms. So we don't know which ones are going to be the survivors or the ones that are, we don't even know what all the best applications are going to be. Crypto is really just the best known at this point.
Right.
But there's a lot of opportunity down the road with blockchain. And I also think combined with AI.
Oh, yeah? How do you think? Like, how can AI complement the tech?
Well, you know, blockchain's all about algorithms and things like that, right?
Right.
I mean, AI, I think it doesn't have all the solutions, but I think it can help aggregate the data and help understand what the data is.
Yeah, I'm holding out hope that AI is going to eventually translate dolphins and whale languages, finally.
Well, you never know. I actually, during my class, the intro to fintech class, I do one segment on AI. And I have the CEO of a company that does all types of AI that's
right.
going to come in and speak to my class. That's one of the things I'm very proud of in my class, is that I usually have practitioners and guest speakers that come in that are walking the walk and they're living, you know, whatever the subject matter is.
Ah, that speaks to me as somebody who's got humility. It doesn't need to be the one that knows all the answers. You know, like they're willing to call in somebody that is an expert.
You know, it worked for companies.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that we look for when a company presents, are they coachable?
Yes. Yes.
It's not an insult.
No.
All of us can learn all the time. And I think when someone thinks they know everything, that's kind of a little bit of a red flag. And of course, you want someone they're very confident, and you want to be able to support them, but you also want to let them know that there's no dumb questions. You can come and ask us. We have a collective group of people that almost all of them have started their own business at one point that are the investors. Just feel free to reach out to us.
I'd actually argue that it takes more confidence to say, I don't know, but I'll find out.
Yes, I would agree with that. I wish I learned that earlier in my career.
I actually have some really cool stats here. Some of the stats I looked up here, it says that 70% of mentored businesses survive 5 years or longer, and that is twice the rate of unmentored. And the other really interesting stat here is business owners who receive a mentorship increase their annual average revenue by 83% versus an average of 16%. So the types of services that you guys are providing here are really giving these companies quite a leg up.
Well, we like to think so. And, you know, the thing about advice is sometimes it's not always the right.
But true.
It's good to have someone that may counterbalance what you're thinking or augment what your thoughts are about a particular strategy,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, what's the next plan. I also think it, having been a CEO and president of two companies myself, it's a little lonely at the top, and you need to have a really good relationship with your team. And even if you're at a large organization, when I was at State Street, I ran the credit risk division,
mm-hmm.
and I had 45 people reporting to me, and it was good to take input, but at some point, someone has to make a decision.
Yes, right? Yes.
And the other thing I would add with young companies, they often don't have a board,
mm-hmm.
or if they have a board, they don't have independent board members all the time. It's good right. to have an independent board member, too.
Is that something that's good, like at any stage, or is there a point where that's probably not necessarily helpful?
I think the longer a company stays, if a company has traction and it's growing, and I think things get more complex, that's a good time to have a board. You can establish a rudimentary board, I think, immediately. You should,
mm-hmm.
for good corporate governance. And I think you can expand on that as the company starts to scale.
Are there any other like common issues that some of the people that you work with experience that you guys help them through?
One of the hardest things that I learned when I started my own business is acquiring customers. It sounds funny to say that, but the biggest reason startup companies fail is people don't buy the product. It sounds so simple, doesn't it?
Like they have a great idea for a product, but they don't know how to sell it.
You know, the buzzword is the product market fit.
Mm-hmm.
You have the right product market fit. And, you know, what's being promoted now is to do a lot of customer discovery to find out exactly what should the product look like. You know, it's not just about pricing and that sort of thing. You could have a great product, but people may not buy it because they already have a product that's just about as good.
And there may not be a need for it either. Like, I think the Gutenberg press was invented 1,000 years before it caught on in Europe. There just wasn't a need for printed material at that time.
Isn't that kind of the way it is with a lot of technology? I mean, just think of AI, how prominent it is now. AI has really been around in a rudimentary form since the 50s.
Right.
Right? Andrew Turing. So
mm-hmm.
you go through these cycles. And I think that, you know, it's hard to figure out what blockchain can be used for exactly. And we're kind of doing a customer discovery at this point.
Right.
What I've been amazed at is hundreds of platforms that I've seen from a lot of different accelerator groups. It's really amazing, and it's impressive.
Right.
It's impressive, the intellect of some of these groups and the ideas that they have and the products that they're building.
So tell me some of the things that you've learned from the people that you've worked with then. What are some of the things that you've picked up from them?
You mean from the startup companies or just work in general?
Any of the above.
Well, just work in general. What I learned is, it's great to be a great salesperson and a shark and all that, but collectively, if you have a group of people, maybe they work with you or work for you, everyone has good ideas at some point. And it's not about me. It's really about our group. If my group is doing well, it's going to reflect favorably on me.
Yes.
So I think you really need to collect the wisdom from the group, learn from them, and be able to make decisions and, you know, be able to pivot when you make the wrong decision.
That is key. It's hard to admit that you made a mistake and then try to rectify that. A lot of times people have the tendency of continuing pushing down even though they know that they've made that mistake.
It is. I think you said it earlier in our conversation, a little humble pie is good.
Yeah.
That happened earlier in my career. I was a shooting star in the organization and the top producer, and then I had a huge problem in my portfolio, and I got sent to the credit policy area of the bank, and I was unhappy about that. But I learned more, and eventually I was running that area.
Right.
So it was a great opportunity for me because I failed in spectacular fashion, but I was able to come back from that. It was a good learning lesson for me.
See, that speaks to a good mindset, too, is that every failure is just an opportunity to improve. Something happened to get you there. What happened? Analyze that, and then try to turn it into a strength if you can.
I'm going to have you come into my class and say that. I think my students would appreciate that, and they would benefit from that.
We're really good at failing.
Well, you got to keep pushing,
right,
I think.
Right.
One of the things that's kind of interesting is you mentioned that one of the interns here was in my class.
Yes.
One of the reasons I teach is, you know, I'm a lot older than the students. It's good to connect with them. I also have, at my school, at Suffolk University, half my class are international students.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable about, you know, Vietnam, Sweden, Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, Romania. I even had someone from Kazakhstan. And I'm friendly with a former student from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just the litany of countries, and you learn from those countries. And in this intro to fintech class, I have the midterm is a pitch. They have to pitch the class on a particular company. And I have say, gee, you know, if you're from Kazakhstan or Vietnam, why don't you pick a fintech or a blockchain company from your country? And they all, really, there's not that many. When they explore and they research, they find out, wow, there's a lot going on in my country that I didn't know about.
Oh, really?
Wow. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think.
That's awesome. How can people enroll in that class?
You know, I guess you could audit the class if I made arrangements at the school, but it's basically you're enrolled at Suffolk University.
Mm-hmm.
And both of my classes are an elective. You just have to elect to take the class.
Right.
But there are certain minimum requirements. You have to have a certain GPA.
Mm-hmm.
The hurdle's fairly low. And then if you're passionate about coming into my class, I can waive that requirement.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
But you're probably a 4.0 guy, right?
No. I was never a good student. I did the bare minimum of work required to pass the classes so I can go goof off. In fact, I never actually went to college, to be honest with you. I went to the military route.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, which service?
U.S. Navy, submarines. I was a nuke electrician. So actually, MIT, I believe, wrote the nuclear power program course material for our program.
See how impressive that is, your background? I bet I could learn a lot from you. And I'm glad you said the Navy. I'm going to put a plug in for a family member.
Okay.
How about
okay.
that?
Do
is
it.
That, am I allowed to do that?
Yes.
So unfortunately, my favorite aunt just passed away.
I'm sorry to hear.
102 years old, World War II, U.S. Navy.
Oh, that's amazing.
You can learn a lot from a lot of people.
Yes.
And she was there, right? So it's great talking to her and learning about her actual experiences.
Yeah.
But just think of that, 102 years ago.
That's insane. My grandma, she emigrated from Germany. Yeah, because it was when the Russians had actually taken over, because she was in East Germany.
Oh, she was in East Germany. Wow.
So she had some really neat stories.
Well, glad you made it.
Yes, me too.
And glad we were here talking today.
So the personal side, then, I see that you like to travel. Tell me if you've got any good or bad stories, favorite places to visit, anything on that?
Oh, I have so many places. I went to Normandy. Because I've always wanted to go see D-Day.
Yes.
So we went to Normandy. We only spent one day on Omaha and Utah Beach and that sort of thing. It was very cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
And the American Cemetery, of course. Every American should go see that.
Yeah.
And then, Normandy's a beautiful place. We went to a number of places, an oyster farm, a horse farm, all that sort of thing. And then we spent a week in Paris. That was fun.
Yeah.
Doing that. I'd have to say one of the best trips was when I went to Morocco.
Morocco.
So we went to Morocco, and we land in Casablanca. We drove up to Fez, which is where the independence of Morocco started, Fez.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a small tour, about 12 people. And I always had this view of Morocco as just desert.
Yeah.
Well, it's more than that. It's a lot more than that.
Hmm.
And so we traveled around the country. We went up into the Atlas Mountains, and they have skiing there and that sort of thing. I never would have thought that.
Right.
We spent a night out in the desert, and so we rode out on camels.
How cold did it get at night?
It was very cold at night because we were there New Year's Eve.
Oh, man.
So I spent New Year's Eve out in the desert. And by the way, I kept driving by these forts because apparently Morocco and Algeria are having a little bit of a conflict.
Okay.
Military conflict. I didn't realize that. But anyway, so I would say, wow, what a great life. Riding out in a camel. I saw the sunset. We had a big celebration. We got up early, saw the sunrise, and we rode out on camels and that sort of thing. And then we ended up, you know, we ended up in Marrakesh, which is a little more of a modern type of place. And we're in the Medina, you know, the marketplace. Yeah, yeah. And it was a really great experience.
When you were in the desert at night, what did the stars look like there?
It looked like someone put a brush and white paint and just splashed it against a black background.
That was the most incredible thing I think I remember seeing from my experience in the military was we were periscoped out in the middle of the night, in the middle of the Pacific, and then I got a chance to look up through the periscope and with a 16x magnification to like look at the Milky Way itself. Like, man, you just can't get a better view than that.
You can't forget things like that. Another trip was I had the occasion through school to go to Cuba.
Yeah.
So that was a very different type of experience.
When was that?
Probably 6 years ago.
Okay, so not...
There were some leftover visas. I went through an educational visa. And one of the professors is Cuban, and he had connections. And we went there, my wife and I, and again, another small group. And it was amazing. The Cuban people are really nice. They weren't enthused about our government, but they loved Americans. Right. And I learned, you know, a lot about the Cuban people. One of the coolest things was riding in the 55 Chevy.
The other thing
was going to Hemingway's place.
Oh, really?
Yes, where he wrote some of his books.
Interesting.
A beautiful place up on top of a mountain. And so we did that. And there are a lot of other things. And
the vehicles in Cuba, I've heard, are amazing just because the embargoes, they haven't been able to get new vehicles.
They can't get the parts. Yeah. They can't get the parts. And our guides were not. We stayed at the Hotel Nacional, which is where Castro stayed during the Cuba Missile Crisis.
Okay.
And this is a beautiful old hotel. There isn't a lot of new things in Cuba. A lot of things are well-maintained, and a lot of parts of the town have fallen apart because they don't have the money. But that was a different type of a vacation.
Yeah. Wow, man. Sounds like you've seen some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I think that was good. And then sometimes when I introduce myself to my students, I don't go with the CV first.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have pictures of, like, what I did this semester was all the trips I took, a lot of the trips, and they had to guess what towns.
Oh, that's
what countries they're in.
Geo-guessing.
And the semester before, I show all the modes of transportation I've tried. Like I've driven an M4 Sherman tank, you know, riven.
I'm so jealous.
I've flown on a B-24 dog sled. I've done dog sledding, you know, all these different things just to try to show the human aspect of the professor.
I think the human aspect is important. I think that it gets overlooked a lot, but that's the kind of thing that makes you personal. People form better connections, I think, when you share some of those personal details.
You know what it does?
Hmm.
It creates trust.
Yes.
And guess what blockchain's about?
Hmm.
It's a trustless system. There's no third party in the middle. You have to trust the system.
Right.
And the reason fintech and blockchain have done so well is, honestly, a lot of people don't trust the legacy institutions anymore.
Yeah.
Banks and insurance companies, right?
Yes.
Look at 2007 and 8 during the financial crisis. That really gave a leg up with fintech and blockchain.
Did you ever read about what happened in Iceland with their three main banks during that crisis?
I did, because at that point I was at the bank and I was the chief credit officer. So it was a global effect. It just rolled into the United States. Bear Stearns failed. A number of banks failed.
But it was like 10.
Lehman Brothers failed.
In Iceland, it was 10 years of stock price manipulation that had been going on prior to that. It was kind of insane. Those three companies had a higher GDP than most developed nations there.
You know, it was kind of a financial trade and poor supervision, greed. It's always a combination of things like that. That was like the tip of the iceberg because, you know, Iceland's a beautiful place. I've been there too.
I want to go there.
I would go. I mean, it's 4.5 hour plane ride from here. It's beautiful. It's just one of the safest countries in the world. It's clean.
Yeah.
People are very nice, but they were punching above their weight.
Yeah. Well, going back to what you said about trust then, does the lack of regulation in the crypto space make it easier for people to take advantage of that trust?
Well, when you say lack of regulation...
Well, I guess just being a newer industry and emerging tech.
Well, what I would say about that is in the United States, there's a lack of regulation.
Interesting.
In Europe, they have the MiCA.
Right.
They have regulation. And it may not be perfect, and both sides may not like it, but at least you have guardrails.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, it seems like it's more of a punitive thing.
Right.
You know, the legislature can't get together to craft the rules and the regulations
yet. Can't
even
define it yet.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the SEC and a lot of the government agencies are kind of fighting who has the domain over it. And the SEC in particular wants to control it. And, you know, when you're using rulings to determine what a security is that are almost 100 years old,
right.
it's a little bit antiquated. I think what you need is a little collaboration between the industry and between the government, which doesn't seem to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the government's learning a little bit, some of the candidates are talking about, maybe not embracing crypto, but being more receptive to it, is that, you know, in the United States, there's over 50 million people that own or have owned crypto, and they're voters too.
Right.
And I think crypto's global, and it's coming. It's not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I think we need the protections, but we can't, we don't want to stymie innovation.
Right, right. Yeah, it's kind of tricky. Like, you want to have protections for the people so you can prevent things like the FTX incidents and the Three Arrows Capital.
Absolutely.
And that kind of stuff. But
well, FTX was just greed and fraud, and
yeah.
And there were no guidelines or no real laws, but it was just fraud. It was sort of like, you know, you've seen that many times in legacy business. I mean,
yes.
How many hundreds of billions of fines have banks and insurance companies paid because they did something wrong? So it's not just crypto.
Yeah.
I would think, but crypto's a young industry and it has to police itself too.
Point to HSBC and their, when they got caught bringing in garbage bags full of money that they were laundering for drug lords.
You know, poor Wells Fargo, you know, the former president there where they were opening accounts.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not singling them out because
right.
there's been a lot of instances of those things across many institutions. So it's not just restricted to something like crypto.
That's a good point. There's bad actors in every space.
Yeah. But you need, you know, you brought up the point, you need good laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's about collaboration. Collaboration is such a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And compromise.
Yeah.
You know, compromise works. You don't get everything you want, but at least this is how I'm supposed to act. And what I think what's happened, especially, this is just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the school or any chain reaction or whatever. You know, with the SEC, for example, they've decided to go through enforcement and the court system instead of really the collaboration. And they've won a few cases. They've lost a number of cases. And, of course, they don't have new laws, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to step in the breach, I guess. But I think if you work together, you can probably accomplish more.
I would agree with that. Might as well get the people involved who are going to have to be complying with the regulations to help write it.
Exactly. And if you're suing people and fining them all the time, they're going to get tired of that after a while. They're going to say, well, why bother?
Right.
We might as well sue you back.
Yeah. Or you know, things like chain reaction may decide to go pivot to a new technology to try to drive innovation somewhere
that's
else.
That's not going to happen.
No. And, but that's, you know, that's the type of extreme. If you create that kind of environment, you will stymie innovation.
Well, let's face it. As an angel investor, I think while we focus, that's our specialty,
mm-hmm.
a number of us have invested in other types of things.
Yeah.
And I think you have to go where the opportunity is too.
Mm-hmm.
We happen to think that this is just the beginning of a great opportunity using the blockchain technology.
So what do you see for the space then in the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
You know, I think there's still going to be a shaking out of, you know, what are the platforms that will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think the one of the biggest challenges is not really technology, it's adoption. And in the United States, well-developed countries have slower adoption rates. Countries like Africa and China and places that are developing countries, they adopt faster because they don't have the infrastructure and the rules. I would say that the United States is the best place to start a company because of the capital that's here. But it may not be the easiest place for adoption. And
right.
as you were pointing out about the rules and regulations, I've seen a lot of intellect and talent go overseas because there is an environment where you know how you should operate.
Interesting.
In the United States, because we have this I don't want to change thing, you know, some of the hardest things in life are, you know, to move on from things that have been around forever.
Yes.
And not every shiny new object is the best thing either. But if you don't facilitate innovation, it's going to move someplace that will.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that a lot. We're seeing a lot of blockchain companies that are overseas and not in the U.S. because the U.S. is not, you know, fostering that.
I mean, can we point to the automotive industry in Detroit as a kind of side example of failing to adopt innovation?
Yeah, well, you know, if you see all the recalls that a number of companies have, you know, it's not that easy to make a great automobile and all the pieces that go into it. And, you know, EVs are a good example. Mm-hmm. You know, they push. I have an EV, but I also have a pickup truck.
Right.
So I'm trying to balance things off. But I think, you know, maybe the hybrid's a better transition to just strict EV because mm-hmm. there's some great things about it and there's some things that are not so great. You know, range anxiety is a huge thing.
Yeah.
So I didn't charge my car before I came here, and I'm thinking about how much mileage do I have left in my
right.
car. So it may be the hybrid, the plug-in hybrid, but mm-hmm. that's just my opinion, of course. But, you know, it's a good example. They make good cars.
Yeah.
You know, if you compare them to cars in the rest of the world, they make pretty good cars.
Good point. Anything else that you want to leave us on then before we wrap up here?
Yeah, so, you know, we mentioned a little bit about inclusion. We didn't get too deep into that. But, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm an advisor to a group called FinTech Women USA. And so I'll help fostering the careers of women in financial technology.
And that was actually something that we saw yesterday in a presentation that kind of struck us, was that the funding dollar amounts available to females and minorities is actually extremely low in comparison. It's like less than 1% almost.
I think the last statistics I saw for women is about 2% of the venture capital goes to women. And if you look at the stats, the returns are twice as much with women-led organizations.
That to me looks like an exploitable edge that I'm surprised more people aren't jumping on.
You know, you look for talent, you look for good ideas. Chain Reaction, the co-founder of Chain Reaction, Eliza Petro, who will be on one of the panels this afternoon, she's a woman co-founder of this angel group, and I'm very proud of her. She does a great job. FinTech Women, the woman that runs that, she's doing this out of the goodness of her heart and to help women progress in their career.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just startups, of course. It's, you know, progressing your career at larger organizations. And it's all part of that theme of improving, you know, it's more inclusive to do that. And I think it fits with, you know, blockchain and FinTech. Because
yeah.
I think they're more inclusive. You know, when you say 2% of the funding goes to women, that's across all types
right,
of investments,
right.
not just FinTech. So maybe the door's open, but we need to open it wider.
And I think one of the other interesting things that came out of that conversation or that presentation was that there was the blind spots that are involved. Because if you don't have people on your team that have different collective experiences, then you're not going to see the potential of something like a black hair care product or that type of stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think that women are over 50% of the population.
Right.
And the thing I like about FinTech Women is she considers men to be allies.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the enemy, they're allies. They're 50% of the population. And it's about collaboration, working together. But the focus is really on helping women. And all she had to do, I've done workshops with the group, and it opened my eyes to mm-hmm. some of the things that, you know, need to be addressed. Like funding's one of them. I also think that I've learned that, you know, if you're looking to apply for a job, if a man fits 60% of the qualifications, don't quote me on the percentages,
right.
they'll shoot for it.
Mm-hmm.
A woman often will need to be 90, 95% matching up. It's not a confidence thing, you know, I don't think, but I think women should, you know, I think it would be good to have more confidence and shoot for those types of positions. And it doesn't hurt if you get rejected. You know, maybe it's a position you grow into or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned that through a workshop. It was amazing because I don't think like that.
Right.
So, and they're just a great group of people. Another one of my former students has now joined their board as an advisor. So I do keep in touch with a number of my students. It's great.
Quite a wide-reaching network you've built there. Sounds like that's the secret to success. If you want to build a big network, go teach.
I think you have to be willing to change.
Mm-hmm.
I do the school does an evaluation at the end of every course. I do a mid-course evaluation, mid-semester evaluation. Why? Because if things are not going the right way, I can make adjustments. At the end of the semester, what else am I going to do? If I get good feedback, I can't utilize that except maybe in the next semester.
Right.
So the students appreciate that.
I would. Anything else?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Cubic Labs, sponsoring the event, sponsoring this talk, who's engaged with two of my former students as interns, I'm very thankful to them. I'm thankful for them for having Blockchain Week. And, you know, we really have kind of, we need to formalize a partnership, I think, with them. I'd love to see some of the companies that are in their accelerator come and pitch to us. That would be another great way to do that.
So there's not like a competition between two of you, right? It's collaborative.
Yeah, we're more funding. And, you know, sometimes we can do some mentoring or advisory type of work. They're really getting these companies positioned, maybe it would be on a technology basis or helping them put their pitches together or their strategy or whatever. Without the accelerators, a lot of them wouldn't be in a position to even try to raise capital because they would be, they have not gone through the process before. They don't know what to do. So I'm thankful to Cubic. I'm thankful for a technology that I expect is going to be one of the most game-changing things in the future. And instead of AI, which is vaulting ahead, I think it's more of a slow, steady type of progress. I'm also thankful that blockchain is going to help create a lot of startup and new companies that I'll take a look at, and it'll be a great learning process. And, you know, the final thing is really about my students. They loved the Blockchain Revolution course. They really loved it because of the guest speakers that I bring in, the interactive things that we did. We did one thing on blockchain and AI, and we had VR units, and I had a practitioner come in and demonstrate how that works. And it also, one of the things I'll end up with is, in my classes, when the guest speaker comes in, I always ask them to tell their story. And most of them started in some legacy company, and they pivoted to, you know, whatever fintech or blockchain company that they're involved in, you know, like Circle or something like that. And the students are amazed, you know, how they went from one place to another. They give good career advice, and the networking has been good. They've helped a lot of my students, and I'm incredibly thankful for that, too.
It's really interesting. They went from legacy to probably something that I'm guessing gives them a little more fulfillment in their life.
That, and, you know, maybe you're an inquisitive person, right? And you want to learn more. And I think you have to evolve. Just think of what my position was, chief credit officer of a $200 billion corporation, to starting a lending company, lending platform company that I've never met my customers.
Right.
So that was a leap of faith for me.
Yeah.
But I think if you're not moving ahead, you're falling behind.
I'd agree with that. Thank you very much for your time, Ken. I'm looking forward to seeing your presentation tomorrow. Really appreciate the talk here, and it's just some of the insights and fun stories.
It was great to be here, and don't forget that my colleagues are the smart ones, not me.
I would say the same for us. The cover art for this podcast was custom designed for us by the amazing people at Epic Made. Epic Made is a digital art and animation studio that actually understands the magic behind powerful creative assets for gaming, entertainment, and tech. So visit epicmade.com to get expert creative help for campaigns, commercials, socials, and more. That's epic-made.com. DSpark is the leading user research platform for Web3. Companies can easily get feedback from any type of user, helping them build better products and improve their marketing. If you're interested in giving feedback, get paid USDC to share your opinions and improve Web3. Visit DSpark.io today. That's DESPARK.io. Bola allows you to create, tokenize, and finance invoices and manage all of your on-chain accounts. With TCS Blockchain, they recently went live with their groundbreaking solution that uses blockchain to settle freight invoices 90% cheaper and faster than traditional means. Thank you for helping make this show possible, Bola. Go to bolanetwork.com and tcsblockchain.com to learn more and join the waitlist. Numbers Protocol harnesses blockchain technology to enhance authenticity and traceability of digital content globally, with operational bases in London, LA, Dubai, and Taiwan. Recognized as the best in Web3 at the 2023 SXSW Awards and supported by Google and NVIDIA, Numbers Protocol offers the Capture, an all-in-one suite for content verification, copyright protection, and monetization. This technology has proven pivotal in projects like the archival of the 2020 U.S. presidential election and supports artists and businesses in ensuring the integrity and security of digital media. Jotto is a cutting-edge platform that amplifies the customer voice by making it simple for organizations to gather feedback through video, audio, and text. Using powerful AI, Jotto analyzes this feedback in real time to deliver actionable insights that help organizations understand their audience better. Whether it's governments, businesses, or events, Jotto enables a deeper connection by ensuring every voice is heard and valued. It's an essential tool for anyone looking to turn raw feedback into strategic actions and drive meaningful engagement. So once again, thank you to our sponsors for helping make the show possible, and thank you everybody for listening. The views and opinions expressed on this program are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial, legal, or professional advice. Always conduct your own research and consult with a qualified professional before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast. We appreciate your understanding and hope you enjoy the insights and expertise shared in today's episode.